We will now begin a very brief and superficial review of the important bioethical documents that have come out of the Magisterium of the Church, particularly as a result of papal addresses and formal letters, as well as from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith and the Catechism of the Church as a summary document. But we'll also include the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, which, although not representing the Magisterium of the entire Church, nonetheless does have the right to legislate for Catholic institutions in the U.S., and we'll see that the document we'll be looking at, their ethical and religious directives, are normative for healthcare institutions in the U.S. that want to describe themselves as Catholic. The treatment will be given to each of these will be rather light and, as I say, rather superficial, simply to give us a kind of an impression of the overall sweep of these documents and of the very large number of issues with which the Church has deliberately attempted to grapple. We will be looking at the relevant sections of these documents in more detail in the appropriate sections of the course. So please do not become perplexed if your favorite document is given rather short shrift in the next couple of lectures. We begin with a document that is of vital importance from the standpoint of the Church's description of life, and particularly of the significance of marriage, and that is Pope Paul VI's brilliant and prophetic encyclical Humanae Vitae, which, as we know, was reviled shortly after its publication, and continues by some in the Church to be highlighted as an instance of a document that has not been taken seriously. And while it may be true that it hasn't been taken seriously, that does not change the fact that it is absolutely fundamental to our understanding of a number of very important ethical and moral issues, and that it was, in fact, the basis of John Paul II's theology of the body. A very large number of people who criticize it most vigorously give the impression of never actually having read it. So we will look at a couple of passages now, and then in the relevant sections of the course, look at it in more detail, so that that cannot be said of us, namely that we have not read it and looked at it closely. So I've included some sections that are of importance for later documents, in which one can regard this text as being foundational, or even with the admonition at the end, prophetic. And in section 2, number 8, we find, and I've highlighted in the text, this beautiful passage, through mutual self-giving, which is unique and exclusive to the spouses. Spouses seek a personarum communionem, a communion of persons. These two notions, that marriage involves an act of offering, that it involves an act of oblation, of self-giving to the other, and that it entails a communion of persons, highlights what is said at the very beginning of this passage, that conjugal love has its origin in the God who is love. In other words, as will be reiterated after this document, and particularly by John Paul II, the communion of persons which God is, the Blessed Trinity, is a personarum communionem. This communion is mirrored very beautifully and visibly in the context of the love between man and woman in marriage, which is why this sacramental union is of such great importance, both from the standpoint of understanding our life as human beings, and why it's so important for the Church to continue to safeguard and esteem this sacrament so highly. These two terms, this an emphasis on mutual self-giving and communion of persons, will be taken up from Humanae Vitae and will become thematic in the decade to follow. Again, if we drop down now to number 10, there is a statement that is often not appreciated at all. I've called it in brackets number 3 and then highlighted numbers 1 and 2. This numbering is my own. The only numbering you find in the document is that this is section number 10. The Pope says that responsible parenthood is exercised by number 1, those who elect to accept many children, and also by those who decide not to have another child for a definite or an indefinite amount of time. So, presuming that the individual's motivation for spacing pregnancy or of deferring children at the present time, these are legitimate within marriage. And those who have chosen to have large families cannot claim that theirs is the only legitimate approach to being Catholics. If they say that, they have not read Humanae Vitae and not understood the principle principles on which it's based. The Pope quite rightly recognizes that there may be legitimate reasons for spacing or deferring pregnancies, and we'll come back to this in just a moment. In number 11, he points out the fundamental principle that conjugal acts, sexual intercourse, it does not cease being legitimate if the spouses are aware that they are infertile for reasons that they have not caused. So to make use of a period that one knows to be infertile is not the same thing as deliberately contracepting. It represents a very different approach to one's own fertility and awareness of what one is as a human being, and it certainly involves level of communications between the couples that would not occur in the context of artificial, contraception by any means. So the statement that is hard for people to understand that I've highlighted toward the end of number 11, it is necessary that each and every conjugal act remain ordained in itself to the procreating of human life. That does not mean that a sterile couple can't have sex. On the contrary, they can, and can indeed have a sacramental marriage. It means that the act must be open to the twofold nature, which is described in number 12. And the twofold nature of sexual acts are that they have a unitive and a procreative significance. And notice here that the ordering is not in the document. I've put in the bracket 1 and bracket 2, but notice that the ordering here is unitive first and procreative second. This is a change, a shift from what one finds in earlier documents where the procreative is listed first, and one often has statements implying that therefore the procreative dimension is superior to or is more important than the unitive or union creating aspect of sexuality. That is not what the Church teaches. This is clearly stated in later documents, but one finds it already in Humanae Vitae. The connection between these two meanings or aspects of sexuality was established by God, and both essential meanings must be preserved, that of union and procreation. And if this is done, the conjugal act fully maintains its capacity for fostering both love and being ordained to the highest mission of parenthood, the highest mission to which human beings are called. So if we now move down to number 15, again a statement that is often misunderstood. The Church does allow the use of medical treatment that causes sterility or a decrease in fertility if that's not what is intended. That is, a woman might well be taking hormonal therapy, which has the secondary effect of causing infertility, and if the goal is not to render the woman infertile, then those medications are perfectly permissible. And here, too, in number 15, there's a reiteration and clarification. There may be serious reasons for spacing offspring, and they may be based, and again, I've added these numberings, on physical, psychological, or what we would call social, external factors. And the Church teaches that it is morally permissible for spouses to calculate their fertility by observing natural rhythms inherent in the generative faculties and to reserve intercourse for infertile times. We'll talk a little more about this in terms of intentionality in our section on fertility later in the course. But I'd like to conclude our brief glimpse at Humanae Vitae by noting what I have highlighted. And by the way, the sections that are in a kind of a dark blue background with white type are my own comments. They are not in the original document. And in particular, that's true here of what I've described as the prophetic consequences, the serious consequences of using artificial birth control. And number 17, how easy it would be to justify behavior leading to marital infidelity or a gradual weakening in the discipline of morals. And I would say one cannot look at the history of our own culture since the 1960s, since the availability of widespread contraception, and not have to agree that not only was it easy, but indeed precisely this did in fact happen. And the next section highlighted in white, it's to be feared that husbands who become accustomed to contraceptive practices will lose respect for their wives. They may come to disregard their wives' psychological and physical equilibrium and use their wives as instruments for serving their own desires, no longer viewing their wives as companions who should be treated with attentiveness and love. And I've highlighted below this in gold against a blue background that clearly data from on natural family planning has demonstrated the truth of this by pointing out that couples who practice natural family planning are much more likely to remain in the marriage covenant. The divorce rate, that is, and as well as the couple's capacity to communicate with one another, is certainly much higher in the context of people who practice natural family planning. And then the Pope goes on to say that it can be expected that nations will enforce contraception in order to, as he puts it, employing these as a solution for what are regarded as social problems. This, of course, has indeed happened in countries, particularly in the Far East, especially in China, where there are laws against having more than a small number of children, and effectively contraception or even abortion become not only available but mandatory. Finally, we've already looked at the beginning of the course at the principle of gradualness. Just a reminder here that in number 29, the use of natural family planning, the shifting of a whole mentality, and this was in the 60s, if it was true then, it's certainly even more true now, is something that requires great pastoral care, tolerance, charity, and patient mercy offered towards sinners. And the key at the bottom: teach spouses by using the sacraments never to become discouraged because of their weakness. Now again, we've only briefly glimpsed at certain aspects of this important encyclical, but the point was to highlight how many elements of it will become operative in and reiterated in subsequent papal documents, subsequent articulations of the Magisterium. If we move now down to document 1.1, the Declaration on Procured Abortion in 1974 from the Sacred Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, this too is an absolutely foundational document that clarified and specifically enunciated principles that would be taken up in the Catechism and in virtually all subsequent documents that would deal with beginning of life issues. And it acknowledged the history which we have looked at in so much detail. Looking at number 7 of this document, the text specifically declares that there have been various opinions on the infusion of the spiritual soul, but never any doubt as to the illicitness of abortion, which is the subject of this particular document. It was never denied that procured abortion, even during the first days, was objectively grave fault. If you drop down then to number 10, and again, what this has highlighted is the Church's absolute willingness to acknowledge its history and see it in the context of the development of doctrine, which is now being articulated with greater clarity than has been possible before. That in number 10, there are certain rights which society is not in a position to grant, since these rights precede society. Society rather exists in order to preserve and to enforce them, and the first of these is life. Society does not have the right to legislate in regard to a right of life to some and not to others. Then finally, number 12, or rather additionally in number 12, discrimination based on stages of life is no more justified than any other discrimination. The right to life remains complete in an old person, even one greatly weakened, and is not lost by one who is incurably sick. This will be very specifically enunciated in the document on euthanasia. But the right to life is no less respected in the small infant just born than in the mature person, and indeed the process of generation begins, and notice the text that I've highlighted, from the time that the ovum is fertilized, a life is begun. So taking advantage of the developments in embryology and in genetics and in the sciences, especially in anatomy and physiology, the Church clearly articulates that from the time the ovum is fertilized, a life is begun. As we'll see, some theologians have attempted to quibble, pointing out that fertilization is not a moment, but a process. And we'll deal with this later in the course, but noted in passing when we look at the footnote that I've included below. And notice that it goes on to say, the text goes on to say, that this is the life of a new human being. So from fertilization, one has a new human being. As we'll see, the church will go on to say at a later time that this individual should enjoy all the rights of a person, even though the language of personhood is rather variable depending upon the philosophical system one's using. But from the time of fertilization, one has the life of a human being. It's pointed out in number 13 that modern genetics has confirmed this. Now, notice in the text of footnote 19, very specific statements. This declaration expressly leaves aside the question of the moment when the spiritual soul is infused. So the church is not stating when there is a soul. That is not an issue which this document is addressing. It is saying that at the moment of fertilization, there is a human life. The question of the soul is separate. The text goes on to say, it's not within the competence of science to pronounce on this question because the existence of an immortal soul is not a scientifically provable or debatable point. It's specifically enunciated that even if one imagines, this is not stated, but even if one believes that animation, that is the bestowing of the soul, occurs later, nevertheless, one has nothing less than a human life preparing for and calling for a soul, and it suffices that the presence of the soul be probable, and one can never prove the contrary. So, basically, this is an attempt to deal with arguments that might be raised by those who are still convinced that there are grounds for believing that the human embryo does not have a soul until a certain point in gestation. That does not change the church's teaching that from the moment of conception, from the moment of fertilization, there is a new life, and it is a human life. The statement, it's not up to biological sciences to make a judgment on questions that are, in fact, philosophical and moral, such as the moment when a human person is constituted or the legitimacy of abortion. These are not scientific questions. These are moral questions and pertain to philosophical and, indeed, theological issues. Those are very clear and foundational statements made in this document. And if we now move down to number 1.2, Jura et Bona, we will find some very similar foundational statements being made on the subject of euthanasia that will be reiterated continuously in subsequent documents as well. What we find in number 1.2, the document Jura et Bona, this declaration on euthanasia that was issued in 1980 by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, is a foundational statement of care for people at the end of life. It is not just on euthanasia. It's a brilliant recapitulation of the tradition concerned particularly with ordinary versus extraordinary or proportionate versus disproportionate means that we've seen clearly articulated by St. Alphonsus Liguori. It's the application of those principles in the modern era and also the clear statement of some very true and brilliant insights concerning care for people at the end of life and their requests, which sometimes wrongly are interpreted as requests for death. Let's look at this summary. Again, I've only selected a few passages from this document, which we'll look at in more detail. The definition of euthanasia, an action or omission which by itself or by intention causes death in order that suffering may in this way be eliminated. There's the reiteration of the fact that nothing and no one can in any way permit the killing of an innocent human being, whether embryo, fetus, adult, infant, elderly person, person with an incurable disease, or a person who is dying. No one can do this, and one who is in this situation does not have the right to ask for expect euthanasia for themselves or for another person. And one does not have the right to consent to it, nor does any authority legitimately recommend or permit such an action, even though, of course, such actions are, in fact, taking place rather more widely in the world today, particularly in the Holland and, to some extent, in Belgium and in the United States in the Pacific Northwest, where assisted suicide has been made non-prosecutable. We'll talk about this a bit more, rather like the circumstance we saw in regard to eugenics. It's strange and ironic that something which was reviled after the Nuremberg trials, that is to say, the euthanasia policies which were employed by the National Socialists as a part of their eugenics efforts, and which were then regarded as evidence of the most demonic and destructive activity of which human beings were permitted, it's strangely ironic that it would have been in countries which the Nazis first conquered that these practices would again emerge, as if all it takes is a couple of generations which forget the horrors of these practices for them to reemerge yet again. But as we've seen, euthanasia and the request for assisted suicide is documentable right back through recorded antiquity and was extremely common in the Roman Empire. It is Christian resistance to this that in some ways represents the exception. So if we look down, I've put my own little comment here in a blue bar. Requests for euthanasia are often pleas for help. This is absolutely true. If instead of killing people who ask for assisted suicide, one instead treats their pain, the majority of people asking for suicide decide that they actually don't want to die. And the church recognizes and states this very clearly. The pleas of gravely ill people who sometimes ask for death are not to be understood as implying a true desire for euthanasia. In fact, it is almost always a case of an anguished plea for help and love, and one might add the kind of love and help that involves stopping them hurting, dealing with their pain. So specifically, the next section, number 3, is on the absolute permission for the majority of sick people, the use of medicines capable of alleviating or suppressing pain, even though these cause semi-consciousness and reduced lucidity, is normal. Not everyone can be expected to have a heroic motive of dying imposed on them. Some may choose to wish to be conscious and not to make use of painkillers, but that is in no sense required or normative for Christians or for Catholics. This is very important to bear in mind because there are some recently who have begun to emphasize the fact that they believe one must always be conscious towards the end of life in order to receive the sacraments. Well, one might respond that the sacrament of anointing does not require consciousness for its efficacy, and that's one of the Church's great graces and gifts to us. So it's important not to allow our faith or our practice to become a dangerous form of a sadistic manipulation of other people for our own spiritual ends. There's in the next section, number 4, an acknowledgement of the more common modern use of the terms proportionate or disproportionate rather than ordinary and extraordinary. And as we've mentioned before, this does refer to different things. And the statement is that in the past, moralists tended to use the language of extraordinary. Some prefer to use the term proportionate or disproportionate. And the value in this is that this invites us to compare the elements with the result that can be expected. Ordinary or extraordinary looks at the means, at how the person experiences them, whether they subjectively cause burden or suffering or expense, or whether they're easily available. The notion of proportionate, disproportionate looks beyond those questions to the very important question, what are you trying to achieve? What is the goal of therapy? And is the investment in suffering proportionate to the expected benefit? And then there is very clearly stated that it is permitted to make use, if one wishes to, of experimental procedures or methods, and also to interrupt them if the patient wishes. But this must be with the patient's consent. Some people can choose to participate in experimental protocols in order to show their generosity towards the rest of humanity. But, of course, that's not required. And if we move down a little bit, it may be decided by those who are treating the patient that the investment in instruments and personnel is disproportionate to results foreseen, and or that techniques may impose on the patient strain or suffering out of proportion with the benefits, in which case it is appropriate to interrupt these means. And this is important. Some people imagine that once you've started something, you have to continue it. No, you do not. You do not have to continue it unless it is proportionate to the expected results. If what you are doing for the person is going to help them, fine. But stopping something that you've started because it's not achieving a result is a moral and appropriate decision if indeed it's not serving a good purpose. Now, notice in these final sections that we're looking at, these kind of brightly highlighted texts, it's permissible to make do with normal means that medicine can offer, but, and I've highlighted with large text, the observation, one cannot impose on anyone the obligation to use a technique which may be available, which may be readily available, but, number one, and I've added these numbers, carries a risk or is burdensome. And again, the definition of burden is something that can be only provided by the person who is themselves suffering. This refusal to use even normal means that are experienced as risky or burdensome is not, the church says, suicide. Instead, it should be considered an acceptance of the human condition, a wish to avoid a procedure that's disproportionate, or, and this is regarded as legitimate, a desire not to impose excessive expense on the family or the community. So the refusal even of ordinary means that have become burdensome as the individual experiences them is legitimate. And that's particularly true, as this last paragraph highlights, when inevitable death is imminent in spite of the means used. Now, what does imminent mean? It doesn't mean minutes or hours or days. There is no definition of imminent. It means that death is going to happen no matter what you do. This person is going to die, and there isn't anything you can do to prevent it. And it's going to happen within a short period of time. What's a short period of time? There is no absolute definition of that. One has to rely on the medical community to define that one is on a dying trajectory that cannot be reversed. In this situation, the decision to refuse forms of treatment that would only secure a precarious and burdensome prolongation of life is permissible. So especially in the context of people who are dying, it is permissible to refuse anything. They can stop doing anything. Because again, one of the normal ways by which people die is that towards the end of life, one stops eating and drinking. One stops wanting means that are normal for other people, but with the body shutting down, with various chemicals being secreted into the bloodstream, the individual does not experience the thirst or the pain associated with not eating or drinking, and forcing them to take food in the last days or weeks of life for some individuals can be a form of torture. So it is for the individual to determine whether or not what they're being treated with constitutes a burden. And we will come back to this document when we look more specifically at end-of-life issues.